Anya found herself standing barefoot on the threadbare carpet in the hallway, wrapped in a white bathrobe. She did not carry the sword, since she felt certain she was much more likely to encounter alarmed innocent tourists or hotel staff than any crafty cat burglars. What she did encounter was Dan Seddon, wearing a pair of weathered jeans and a look at once furious and bewildered. His own hair stood out in random directions. Anya thought he resembled Calvin from the Calvin and Hobbes cartoons she'd loved growing up. She fought a semi-hysterical impulse to giggle.
So I wasn't the only one who had a night visitor. You look like an avenging angel on a bad air day.
You're one to talk. What did you see?
A woman. Tall, thin, looked African. Had one of those headdresses on, you know, the ones with the flared tops. She warned me not to keep seeking the Columbu of dreams.
And I suppose she vanished without a trace?
Yeah. I rolled over to turn on the bedside lamp, and when I rolled back, I was all alone. Something like this tempts a man to believe there might actually be something to the stories about these Promasons possessing mystic powers.
It's some kind of trick. It's got to be.
Was your window open? Did you find any sign the door had been jimmied? From your expression, I'm taking that as a no on both counts.
Well, still, I'm not ready to buy into astral projection or anything.
Well, if they have some kind of technique of holographic projection, that'd be pretty significant in and of itself, wouldn't it? Moran seems to think whatever secrets the Promasons have are primarily technological, although he doesn't say much about the mystic powers one way or another.
But I smelled him. He smelled of soil and plants, like the rainforest.
You know, in the late 1990s, the Department of Defense was claiming to be able to stimulate various kinds of sensory hallucinations by beaming microwaves directly into people's skulls. Maybe the Promasons are using a technology that isn't really that advanced, just secret.
No, I had the absolute conviction he was really physically there. That I could have hit him with my fist, if only I'd been quick enough.
Publico said you were a martial arts expert with more than a little rough and tumble experience. I like that in a woman. And yeah, I had the same sense about the woman in my room, although it didn't occur to me to hit her. But which impossibility is going to upset your worldview the most? Astral projection, some kind of technological projection, or teleportation?
I think I'll just go back to bed and try not to speculate in the absence of sufficient data.
Or an overabundance of uncomfortable data.
I thought you were the hard-headed skeptical type, too.
Well, maybe I'm more of a reflex skeptic. Sometimes being a skeptic means distrusting the official explanation. Especially when you've seen official explanations revealed as flat-out lies as often as I have. I guess I'll go back to bed, too.
Suddenly, there was an awkward tension between the two, and they stood there a moment longer, not precisely looking at each other, not precisely looking away.
Well, good night.
Night.
Followed closely by Dan, Anya Creed pushed inside the dank shop in the alleyway. Outside, it was full noon and the sun was blazing. Their eyes, dazzled by the light, took time adjusting to the darkness within the shop.
Hola, Mafalda. Mafalda? Where are you?
Maybe she stepped out.
And left the door unlocked? This may not be Rio de Janeiro, but that'd be pressing her luck even here.
Maybe the locals are afraid of her magic.
I thought you don't believe in magic.
But they do. What's that smell?
The odor hit Anya, too. Beneath the astringent smells of herbs and powders, of dust, and the moldering bindings of old books, lay a smell of sweetness and something foul.
Oh, Christ!
On the counter, to the right of the door, Mafalda lay with her head still wrapped in its bright turban, propped on the cash register. Otherwise, she was nude. She stared fixedly at the ceiling. Feathers had been stuffed in her mouth, and mystic symbols had been scrawled on her bare belly in blood. Her blood. Mafalda's throat had been slit. Fast motion caught the corner of Anya's eye. She spun, reflexively bringing up her right forearm. A wooden pole struck her forearm. She could see from the glint of light that the wood was the haft of a spear. Above the far end of the spear, she saw the eyes of her visitor from the night before, burning in the gloom like dark stars. Before she could react further, the spear was withdrawn, and it darted back at lightning speed straight for her eyes. She twisted her body clockwise and leaned back, allowing the weapon to thrust past her.
Anya!
Anya caught a flash of Dan in the corner of her eye, struggling with an opponent of his own. She had no attention to spare him. Her own foe was remarkably fast and determined. His third thrust came low, and Anya jumped high into the air to avoid the strike at her legs. She lashed out with her right foot, kicking a set of stout jars from the top shelf of a display toward her attacker. As one heavy jar tumbled toward his head, spilling orange powder that glittered even in the gloom, he reflexively jerked the spear back to interpose the haft. Anya used some of the energy of her fall to add momentum to a spinning, straight-legged reverse kick. The back of her heel caught the spear haft and wrenched it right out of the man's hands. He spun and darted toward the back of the shop, and Anya chased after him. A pair of machetes hung crossed on the back wall. The man snatched down not one, but both at once, and turned on his pursuer. He waved the heavy 2-foot blades in a whistling figure eight before him. Hoping Dan was too busy with his own assailant to notice anything else unusual, she held her right hand as if gripping something and focused her will. The man's eyes widened as the broadsword materialized from thin air, but the two big single-edged blades never faltered in their complex dance of death. Anya whacked at one of those dervish whirling blades with her sword. More than a foot of the man's dark steel blade shot away to embed itself in the wall. He stopped to stare in amazement at the surface where his machete had been chopped off. Anya flowed forward and whipped the sword around in a horizontal backhand stroke that should have separated the long-haired head from wide copper shoulders. Instead, the man bent his upper body to his left, away from the stroke. The blade passed just over his head, slashing free a lock of hair. He thrust for Anya's belly with his remaining machete. The speed and fury of this strike would have impaled her had she not leaped back and left like a cat. Unfortunately, the motion slammed her hip into another counter laden with Mafalda's exotic merchandise. A choking cloud of dust and bits of ground herb and tiny wisps of feather floated up to surround Anya's head, her eyes filled with tears. He rushed her again, raising the machete to chop her down. In dodging, she had turned half away from him clockwise. She gripped the long hilt of her sword with both hands and thrust almost blindly toward the onrushing figure. She felt a momentary resistance as he ran onto the blade. His eyes blazing with determination, he drove himself onward, sending the sword point out through his back. The man fought to bring his raised weapon down in a self-avenging death stroke, but his fading strength betrayed his will. The machete fell from fingers that could no longer grip, and blood ran from the corner of his mouth. A look of infinite sadness, almost verging on apology, came into the blazing black eyes, before all the light went out of them, turning them dull as stones. Anya grimaced. Killing was never easy. She had to remind herself that he attacked first, and as far as she could tell, had either killed Mafalda or had guilty knowledge of the deed. Anya snapped back to the moment and spun in time to see Dan fly upside down into a tall bookcase against one wall, then crash through a long table and a crowded set of shelves. The broken remnants fell to the floor in an immense swirl of dust and magic powders. In her shock, she let go of the sword, and it returned to its own sphere. A tall, wiry, African-looking woman in a flare-topped white headdress stood over him. Anya had never seen any woman throw a grown man like that. Nor any man, for that matter. The woman straightened. For a moment, she stood facing Anya, sliding her gaze past to take in the dead man sprawled on his face on the floor right behind her. The woman's handsome features twisted in a grimace of grief that tore at Anya's heart. She whipped her right hand up with striking viper speed. Anya dove over the counter she had slammed against mere seconds before, barely averting the woman's hand as it came level with her dark eyes. A blinding green flash suddenly filled the shop. It filled Anya's head with what seemed like emerald needles, stabbing and ricocheting inside her skull, causing even the backs of her eyes to hurt. Dazzled, she hit the far side of the counter. She could smell smoke. Anya came up onto all fours, then began moving cautiously forward as another green flare lit the shop. The counter's bulk had absorbed a shot meant for her. She realized the energy weapon had some limitations, probably including a recharge time. Otherwise, the woman would simply hold down the trigger and slash through Anya's concealing counter until she found flesh. Armed again with the sword and crouching with one hand on the gritty floor, Anya stuck her head around the counter's end. Anya had withdrawn just before the other woman could fire, but now she had a clear picture of where her adversary was positioned. She launched herself in a low dive, turning it into a forward roll that carried her past the foot of the main counter, where Mafalda lay. Fortunately, her blood had pooled at the other end. The shot had turned the middle of the counter into flaming fragments, some of which seared Anya's bare leg. She gathered her limbs under her, and with all the strength that fear and fury could lend her, leaped over the counter and Mafalda's body. Dazzling though it was, the beam itself missed Anya. She slashed blindly with the sword and felt it bite and pass through the scarcely yielding solidity of wood, not flesh. Blinking wildly at tears of agony, she pressed forward. As her vision returned, it was to glimpse her opponent's sandaled heel vanishing into an oblong of brilliance that must have been a back door. She looked back to see Dan sitting up amid a jagged jumble of broken wood and glass, his hair and shoulders dusted with bits of iridescent feather. He was holding his head in his hands. Anya instinctively pursued the woman. She sprinted toward the light, bursting out into the heat and glare at full speed, then shooting across the narrow alley. Anya slammed into a wall just as a green flash, blindingly bright even in the sun's full glare, blasted just behind her. She looked up to see her opponent just as she disappeared around a right turn in the narrow way. The woman had snapped a shot toward where she judged her opponent would appear, not calculating that Anya would blow right through the doorway kill zone to the alley's far side. Anya ran after the vanished woman. She put the sword away as she raced along the alley, knowing that a tall white woman chasing a black one was likely to attract enough unwelcome attention. Anya found herself confronting a broad street full of people in bright clothes, staring in some consternation after the tall woman who had just plowed through them.
Thief!
Anya knew that to call the woman what she actually was, a murderer, would only bring official scrutiny she definitely did not want. At least her baseless call would give some context to her pursuit in the minds of the crowd. The fleeing woman glanced back over her shoulder, and when she spotted Anya through the crowd, her handsome face twisted in dismay. Already slowed by looking backward, she stopped, turned, and brought up her hand. The muscles of Anya's face contracted in anticipation of a green death bolt, but she kept doggedly moving forward, slowed to a jog by the desire not to jostle the passersby. The woman in the flared turban pointed her hand at Anya, but she couldn't see what her attacker held. Anya's brain screamed for her to dive to the sidewalk, but instead she made herself forge on, slowly closing the gap. She made her eyes hold the other woman's gaze and spotted indecision and frustration ripple across the beautifully chiseled dark features like wavelets across a pond. The woman dropped her arm and stepped sideways into a door. Murderer or not, she had scruples about shooting into a crowd and the self-control to heed them. The Promason had some conscience, at least. The frame of the door had a warped wooden jamb covered in healing blue paint, and the door itself had not closed all the way. Anya plunged inside. It was dark, but a bit of light fell on the floor from a fly-specked, yellow-stained window at the far end of the corridor. Anya smelled strange spices and some kind of chemical cleanser. She was obviously in a tenement. Anya raced up a narrow wood stairway to her left. Suddenly, a shadow fell as someone leaned into the light spilling from above. Anya ducked to the wall as a brilliant green lance stabbed down, blasting the railing to splinters a few feet from her and sending up a curl of stinking blue smoke. She summoned the sword. She wasn't sure what good it would do her against a laser, but it made her feel slightly better, at least. Anya judged from the sound that her opponent had taken off down the third-floor hallway and raced after her, sweat streaming down her face and body and breath burning in her lungs. She was in excellent shape, but combat drained a body like nothing else. She reached the top of the stairs just in time to see that the woman was almost at the corridor's end. Sensing Anya, she spun. Anya had to lean over the wooden railing to avoid the shot and almost toppled back down the stairs. The woman burst through a door to her right into an apartment, and Anya, vanishing her sword, followed. The people in the little flat were frightened. A short, wiry woman stood with a disregarded cigarette, endangering her ebony fingers. Her companion, a younger, taller woman, had just turned away from a pot on the stove. A wooden spoon was raised and dripping. Both stared out the open window. The two women turned to stare at Anya. They didn't seem outraged at her intrusion, or even surprised.
What happened?
She disappeared?
Disappeared?
out the window.
Fell? Flew like a bird?
Just disappeared.
Anya ran to the window and looked down. There was a small yard below, mostly a tangle of weeds and shrubs. She saw no sign of a fallen body, nor any readily visible way to get down, shy of jumping. At something over 20 feet from the ground, Anya would have expected to see her quarry limping off down the alley on a broken ankle at best, if not lying totally crippled in the greenery. Anya looked up and saw that the roof came to a peak just above her head. Without pausing to think how ridiculously dangerous it was, she swarmed out. Using minute finger holds in some kind of wood-slatted air vent over the window to scramble onto the roof in defiance of sense, if not gravity. She found herself all alone on a pitched roof of warped, green-painted shakes. The woman in the headdress had disappeared. Dan met Anya on the street 2 blocks from Mafalda's shop. He was bruised, disheveled, and limping.
Oh, don't go back there.
What do you mean?
Dan pointed back from where he came. In the direction of his finger, Anya saw dirty white smoke tumbling up past the rooftops into the sky.
The laser did that?
Not exactly. It did set a couple of fires. But then, when I was searching the shop, the dead guy was suddenly enveloped in this roaring blue fire. I mean, it was like a blast furnace or something. Everything just boomed into flame for 5 or 6 feet around. I barely got out before the whole damn place went up.
Are you all right?
Yeah, sure. As well as can be expected after being thrown through various pieces of furniture by a woman. I mean, no sexism intended or anything.
I was almost as surprised as you were.
Oh, what about you?
I'm fine, but confused. The woman vanished. I hate to use a cliche, but in this case, into thin air isn't a metaphor. So we got Mafalda murdered and came up dry. Not to mention setting the building on fire. This is not shaping up as a successful day.
Well, not as bad as it could be, though. Well, for one thing, they get 100 inches of rain a year here, and we seemed to get about a quarter of it this morning before we left the hotel. I don't think fires spread really easily here. Well, for another, I searched her body and turned up this.
Dan held up a hand to show a scrap of paper with an ugly, rust-colored smear across it. He handed it to Anya, and she saw that all of the text on it was Portuguese.
Searched her body? She seemed pretty naked. Where'd you find that? Or do I want to know?
She had it clutched in her right fist.
It's a shipping invoice. From what translates as River of Dreams Trading Company, way up river in Manaus. That used to be the rubber capital of the entire world.
A clue?
Well, the name's suggestive, I have to admit. But it also strikes me as just a bit convenient.
Well, maybe we're just due for a lucky break. The old street protest instincts tells me that when you hear that sound, it's time to go.
What about witnesses?
I don't know much about this place, and you've told me the slums are a whole lot heavier down in Rio. But I still don't think these people are the sort to talk to police about anything at all.
Maybe we shouldn't hang around to be found here by the authorities.
Ah, now you're learning street wisdom, Grasshopper. Don't make an activist out of you yet.
The sun had set low over the inland forest that grew hard up against the edges of the city. Dan and Anya had spent an exhausting and dispiriting day hunting for further clues to the mystery of the hidden Quilombo. An internet search had turned up frustratingly little on the River of Dreams Trading Company. A good dinner of seafood and the superabundant tropical fruits available in the area had mellowed them somewhat after the jagged events of the day. 2 men sparred before colorfully dressed ranks of worshippers enjoying the spectacle. The combatants, or dancers, seemed to time their moves to the rhythm of the music. Anya strode forward.
Look up there. They're doing capoeira out in the street. Let's watch.
I don't want to intrude on anybody's religious rituals. It could be bad for your health.
Why would these people be conducting their ritual in public if they didn't want people to watch? It's part of the observance. They have private and secret rituals. Trust me on that.
We need to get back to the hotel and set up a teleconference with Publico.
What's the hurry? We've hit a dead end. Unless our employer has some information he's been holding back and cares to share it with us, we might as well fly back to Miami.
Well, don't forget we've got that invoice scrap, not to mention a dead woman.
Jeez, be careful about saying that out loud.
They can't hear us. Nobody's listening. And they wouldn't say anything to the police anyway.
You don't know that. The Brazilian authorities pay snitches the same way people back in the States do. And we're foreigners, not family or friends to any of these people. One wouldn't have too much trouble giving us up to save his own hide.
You've got a point.
Anya turned and walked toward the crowd, leaving Dan to follow or not as he chose. The combatants continued their acrobatic match, stepping forward, stepping back, launching kicks and strikes that the other blocked or dodged just in the nick of time. They played with smiling abandon that made it impossible for Anya to tell whether this was actually a competition or some choreographed ritual. The rhythm of the music seemed to get inside her bones and resonate. She felt a rising sensation of heat. Somehow, she didn't find it oppressive. Oddly, it seemed to well within her, owing little to the heavy, humid, tropical evening air. A small, compact woman approached her from the side. She was dressed in slacks and a tropical flower blouse, and Anya realized from the lines around dark eyes and smiling mouth that the woman must be older.
Are you Americans?
Yes.
Do you know what's happening here?
No, not really.
Welcome to the Hada, the sacred circle. Now watch.
One of the dancers fell into a crouch, then stomped over to the band. He began acting out the motions of hunting through the rainforest.
He is Oshasi. He has momentarily claimed the Berimbau for his use.
That's an Orisha?
Exactly. Oshasi is the Orisha of the hunt. That man is his horse, you see.
Great. A mime. I hate mimes.
Oh, he is not a mime. He is a horse for a spirit named Oshasi.
The odors of the surrounding jungle were slowly being swamped by the smell of the cigars some of the celebrants, men and women alike, were smoking. It was a harsh tobacco and clearly very strong. Anya realized it was making her head swim, and her stomach began to roll like a sea in a rising wind. Oddly, the feeling wasn't entirely unpleasant. She glanced over at her companion, intending to remark on her lightheadedness, but she froze when she saw him. Dan's handsome face had become a purple mask. Tendons stood out in his neck, his fists clenched and unclenched as if crushing walnuts. Suddenly, he thrust forward, and Oshasi's horse looked at him. Recognition came into his pale brown eyes, and he nodded to the young American, then backed carefully away. His attitude suggested a hunter who had encountered one of Brazil's many venomous serpents in the bush. Not fear, but rather respectful caution, wariness. Puffing out his chest, Dan swaggered around the circle in an exaggerated display of alpha male machismo. He looked like a bad Popeye imitation.
Dan? Dan!
When Dan didn't react to her calls, Anya started forward. The diminutive woman at her side laid a gentle but surprisingly strong hand on her forearm.
No, you can do nothing. You must do nothing.
To her astonishment, Anya saw that none of the worshippers seemed to be taking affront at Dan thrusting himself into the midst of the festivities. Suddenly, Dan strutted to the circle of onlookers and seized a half-full bottle of rum from a man dressed in white with frilly sleeves. The man only smiled.
What's going on?
Can't you see? He is taken. He is ridden now by Ogum. A great honor. He must be a very angry young man.
I guess so.
Dan raised the rum bottle to his lips, tipped his head back, and drank until his cheeks puffed like a blowfish, and rum ran down his chin, neck, and the front of his shirt. Suddenly, Dan spit the rum into the street in a great alcoholic spray. Seizing a torch from another participant, he tossed it into the pool of liquid. Dan poured on more rum, and the stream caught in an arc of fire. Before the bottle could go off in his hand, he smashed it in the midst of the flames, which soared up as high as his chest, garish in the near darkness. The burst of light turned his face into a bizarre mask of joyous rage. Dan moved with surprising swiftness and snatched a machete from a rickety wooden platform at one side of the cleared circle. He brandished it above his head in a series of whistling swoops. Then suddenly, he pressed its point against the middle of his sternum, grasped the hilt with both hands, and pushed.
No!
She could see the effort in his muscles as they stood out like cords on his wiry forearms. Nothing happened. The machete was not pointed like a spear, but it possessed a sharp edge. Anya knew Dan was also surprisingly strong for his lean build, and that his effort should have punched the tip right through his flesh. It did not. Dan tore his shirt open to reveal his pale skin remained unbroken. Then he punched both hands at the stars in an age-old gesture of triumph.
You see? That's Ogum. Two things he can't resist. Rum and showing off.
Dan began a wild, swirling dance, swinging the machete. He reeled this way and that, heedless of the onlookers, some of whom began to stumble over each other in their eagerness to get out of his way. He only danced faster. Now that he posed a clear danger to the crowd, a man in white trousers and white and purple headband leaped forward to confront him. Anya gasped as Dan, rage twisting his features, swung the machete at him. The man flung himself into a sideways dive, and the blade hissed harmlessly above him. He did a headstand and flipped back to his feet.
Aye.
Dan was all over the man. Closing in a flash, he grabbed the bystander by the throat and lifted him into the air. There was no way Dan, fit though he was, should have been able to do that. Suddenly, he swung the dangling man and threw him through the air. He smashed through a wooden cart at least a dozen feet away. Anya's head spun and heat rose within her like flames. The fire seemed to rise up through the soles of her feet, her legs, her loins, and her belly. It was almost as if a wind was lifting up behind her. Without conscious decision, her will exerted itself. The sword sprang into her hand. She ran forward into the circle to confront Ogum, in defiance of all sense and judgment.
Ah, Yansa has come!
Anya entered the middle of the circle and took up a stance with the sword tipped back over her shoulder. What was happening made no sense. But it seemed Anya was thinking with a larger mind, one not altogether familiar, yet somehow not totally alien. Her mind saw wind bending palm trees and storms building waves. Lightning filled her thoughts, ripping asunder a black-clouded sky above the gates of an ancient graveyard. Troubling images, yet stirring. For all their fury, violence, and darkness, they were untainted by evil. Rather, they were thoughts of a warrior who relentlessly battled evil. Dan spun to confront her. His eyes were bloodshot. He launched himself at her. He cocked his machete over his left shoulder. A rushing wind seemed to fill her head, her body, her soul. It was as if something, or someone, had command of her movements as she wove through a crashing, clashing, whirling battle with the man. The thinking part of Anya was freewheeling almost as completely as the rest of her. Not with the passions that raged like a tornado within her, anger and joy and the fierce desire for justice, but with confusion. Dan's face streamed with sweat as if the tropical rains had moved in again. His features were purple, suffused with inhuman fury that seemed to mount with each second. Unbalanced and disarmed, Dan staggered away several steps. Then he turned and hurled himself through the air at her, hands bent to claws. Anya took control again. She sent the sword away. The palm heel strike to the center of his chest threw Dan into a backward somersault. Anya stood for a moment before beginning to sway. Suddenly, her head spun and her stomach seemed to rotate in the opposite direction. Anya awakened as a scalding fluid entered her mouth, the foul substance tasting like raw alcohol.
Easy, child, easy. Do you understand me?
Yes.
Good, good.
Strong hands cradled Anya's head on the skirted thighs of a kneeling woman. Her benefactor smiled down from a round face. She was not the woman Anya had spoken to earlier, but a big, ample-breasted woman with mahogany skin. Other faces looked down from above, forming a rough oval against the sky.
What happened?
Drink, child.
I think I've had enough.
Indeed you have. This bowl is only water.
Thank you. I'm so sorry. I don't know what came over me. Over us? How's Dan? Is he all right?
Your friend is fine.
He's right over there.
The woman nodded to her right. 10 feet away, Dan sat with his knees up and his face buried against his legs. Celebrants, most in white, knelt around him, touching him gently but almost furtively. It was as if they were trying to calm some kind of ferocious wild animal.
Is he badly hurt?
Not at all. The power of his rider, Ogun, kept him from harm.
But I knocked him through that rack. Unless it was a dream.
Oh, no. We all saw. You were ridden by Yonson of the Winds. You and your friend are both very holy people. Very fortunate. Well, maybe your man is not so lucky to have been picked out by Ogun. He is a very terrible spirit.
I am so sorry. We did not mean to intrude.
Intrude? We told you. Yonson happened. She took you over good. And it's a good thing she did, too. Ogun got your friend pretty hard, and he seemed pretty unhappy.
That's not possible. We don't practice candomblé. We're American.
Anyone can see that, child. It's a sign. The Orishas have marked you as their own. They don't do that much to foreigners. Obviously, you're acting out some great and powerful destiny.
Who's Yonson? What's she like? And did you see me with a sword?
Of course. Yonson always has a sword. See?
The woman gestured down at her shirt. It was labeled Cavallo de Yonson, Yonson's horse. It showed an African woman dressed in swirling skirts of red and pink and yellow. In one hand, she carried a horsetail fly whisk. In the other, she carried a cutlass.
Yonson. She is the wind, the tornado, and the lightning. She fights like a man for justice alongside her husband, Shangu, the Sky Father, Lord of Thunder.
I don't know how I'd feel about being married to the God of Thunder.
Don't worry. There are some things an Orisha won't ask her horse to do. She prefers to do many things herself.
Anya and Dan had walked back to the hotel with arms around each other for support. Dan had a black eye and half his face was covered by a bruise that had already begun to go green and yellow. Anya's right hip hurt, as did her ribs every time she breathed. She didn't remember being hit during their battle, but she felt as if she'd been used to hammer nails. They said nothing to each other as they crossed the threadbare carpet between the potted palms and the comfortably shabby lobby, nor as they rode the elevator. In silence, they walked the short distance to the adjoining doors of their rooms. Anya got out her key card. Dan followed her inside. She did not question it, internally or aloud. It was somehow unthinkable that he not do so. After what they'd been through, they needed to be together. Sometime in the dark hours of the long tropical night, Dan had risen from Anya's bed and left without a word. As far as she could remember, they had not exchanged a word since their confrontation in the midst of the crowd. She had been somewhat dreading their inevitable meeting, so upon rising, she grabbed her notebook computer and retired to the hotel lobby. She wore cargo shorts, a lightweight buff-colored shirt, and an expression of weary befuddlement. Anya stopped noodling at her journal and looked up as the lobby door opened. A couple of black men in white linen suits walked in. They were very, very big. From the way they moved, they were muscled like the workers on the Belém waterfront, though better dressed. She made herself look away as they swept the lobby with the bug eyes of their sunglasses, suspecting they were gangsters. Their body language suggested they were looking for potential troublemakers, not trouble themselves. Anya was aware that she was operating at a lower capacity than usual and felt numerous aches and pains throughout her body. She suspected that she and Dan had inadvertently been dosed with some kind of strong psychoactive smoke. In the cold light of day, that seemed more and more conclusively the case.
So, you survived.
She looked away as the two big men moved slowly to different sides of the lobby. Dan stood there. He was dressed in a loose shirt over cotton trousers. He looked even more tousled and unshaved than usual. His eyes were sunk in dark, saggy pits.
More or less.
Much as I hate to say it, you look like I feel.
Yeah.
A second pair of men entered the lobby. They were white and bulky, with shaved heads, dark sunglasses, and square jaws jutting from necks wider than their heads. They wore white linen jackets over what looked like t-shirts and white duck trousers. The jackets were tailored loosely enough about their wide upper torsos that they might well have concealed shoulder holsters.
Ah, our esteemed employer arrives.
You know these thugs? I didn't see these guys back at Publico's.
Goran and Mladko, Croatian paramilitaries, his bodyguards.
He uses paramilitaries as bodyguards?
It's supposed to be rehabilitation. He's all about forgiveness, you know.
Through the big glass doors, Anya saw a commotion outside as hotel porters swarmed to a long, low, white limousine with dark-tinted windows. Another huge black man popped out the front passenger door and waved them off. They obeyed with alacrity. Maybe it was the stubby little machine pistol with the magazine in the butt and the separate broom-handle foregrip that he was brandishing none too discreetly. The gunman opened the limo's rear door. At last, out came Sir Ian Moran, Publico himself, looking neat in a lightweight gray suit. He stood, stretched slightly, smiled, and nodded at his bodyguards. Then he tipped his sunglasses down his nose and looked through the windows into the lobby. Dan raised two fingers in a halfway salute. Publico beamed and nodded.
What's Publico doing here?
I emailed him from my cell phone after that stuff went down at Mafalda's.
Sir Ian paused between his two human pillars and swept the room with his gaze. His fine leonine head was held high, the long hair streaming down to his shoulders. He approached Anya and Dan, beaming, a powerful hand held out.
Anya, Dan, so good to see you.
And you?
Anya was trying hard to bottle up the flash of anger and resentment at her so-called partner for communicating with their boss without letting her know. She took Sir Ian's hand, and they shook firmly. He moved on to embrace Dan.
Welcome to Belém, Publico.
Sure, sure. Let's take a walk. It's a beautiful day.
Anya, Dan, and Publico walked down along the river esplanade, the two black bodyguards preceding them. Mladko and Goran winged out from them, a step or two behind. The big man with the machine pistol followed a few steps at the back. It wasn't exactly subtle, but Anya gathered that it wasn't intended to be. In any event, few people spared them more than a glance. She was surprised no one seemed to recognize Sir Ian. It struck her that perhaps nobody associated Publico, dressed in a t-shirt and torn blue jeans and grimacing into a microphone with his sweat-lank hair hanging down his back, with this dapper, obviously wealthy white guy from elsewhere.
We had just about run out of leads here. You didn't give us much to work with, especially after our one major contact was murdered.
Oh, sorry, Anya, dear, but you were fully the skeptic, weren't you? I already told you more than you were willing to believe. That much was plain as the nose on your face.
I'm still a skeptic, and I'm not sure what to believe right now.
What happened to Mafalda did kind of put a damper on our investigation. There's nothing written down about Promesa, at least that we could track down. I get the impression plenty of people know about this hidden Quilombo, but nobody wants to talk to strangers about it.
Do you blame them after what happened to Mafalda?
Ah, but there we have the key bit of evidence, don't we? The fact that she was done in is itself as strong a lead as we could ask, don't you see?
Well, it means that we're on the right trail.
It may or may not. Although it's not as in-your-face here as it is in the megacities down south, crime is a real problem in Brazil. It can hit anybody anytime. After all, we are walking around surrounded by men bristling with guns.
Point taken.
Dealing in candomblé items is a pretty well-respected trade around here, but it certainly doesn't rule out contacts with a bad element. Mafalda might have crossed a business associate, or turned the wrong crime boss down on a sexual proposition.
You really think so? I thought you found the same people in her shop who visited you in your bedrooms the night before. The ones who vanished mysteriously.
Maybe. The vanishing isn't necessarily all that mysterious. We're not from around here, and they are. They know the city much better than we do. And while I never saw Dan's nocturnal guest, mine and the guy in the shop, well, it's not as if wiry little guys who look like Amazonian Indians are rare in these parts.
It was the same woman.
She threw me like I was a child.
You think she displayed superhuman strength?
Look, I don't know. She could have just been real good at martial arts. But it was the same woman, and she shot some kind of energy weapon at Anya.
Maybe.
You told me.
I know, but I've thought about it. It might have been a conventional firearm using a special laser sight. Maybe it was a special effect designed to make it look like some kind of high-tech ray gun.
But then she vanished again on you when you chased her into that tenement room.
Well, again, she might just have known more about the area than I do.
Ah, Anya, for a world traveler, you'd think you'd realize denial is more than just a river in Egypt. You're both forgetting we do have a solid lead. That slip of paper Dan found in the unfortunate woman's hand.
It could just be coincidental, too.
Indeed, it could be. But you two are going to Manaus to find out for certain. And I shall come with you.
The waiting room in the offices of the River of Dreams Trading Company in Manaus was fluorescent bright, with dark-stained hardwood wainscoting, whitewashed walls, and a white drop-tile ceiling. An array of palm-like plants in terracotta pots softened the starkness of an otherwise generically modern design. Big, modernistic murals of the rainforest splashed the walls with bright greens and reds and yellows. Pied tamarins, a famous local endangered species of primate, featured prominently, peering like troll dolls with black raisins for faces and cotton ball wigs. Publico's private jet had delivered them to Manaus shortly after noon, a few hours earlier. It had been one of the richest cities in the Western Hemisphere, and possibly the richest in the Southern Hemisphere, during its heyday as queen of the rubber trade. Unfortunately, the invention of synthetic substitutes and the rise of rubber cultivation in Southeast Asia ended the frenzy in 1920. The city had recently returned to somewhat provisional status as a financial center for Amazonia and much of South America, courtesy of the global economic boom. The place had a seedy, superficial quality, as if all the glossy steel and glass high-rises downtown were fancy paint over cheap plastic. The River of Dreams Trading Company waiting room did little to dispel the impression of tackiness from Anya's mind. It was spotless, but the color struck her as a bit too gaudy, as if someone were trying to hide something.
I'm pissed off. He was holding out on us.
He has his reasons.
But to wait until now? To tell us that this German friend of his had dealings with River of Dreams?
Mr. Toby will see you now. Please follow me.
The receptionist preceded them down the hallway that led into the offices. Toby was a pretty boy. Brazil had lots of those, as Anya had noticed. He had dark, slick hair, a cream-colored suit over a mauve shirt and dusty rose tie, and a ring in his right ear.
It's such a pleasure to meet visitors from North America. They don't often come to Manaus. Please, take a seat.
I'd think you'd get a lot of eco-tourists.
They don't seem to visit our offices. What may River of Dreams Trading Company do for you, Miss Callender? Mr. Stone.
We're here primarily for pleasure. We couldn't resist visiting the famous Manaus Opera House.
Ah, it's definitely a jewel in our crown.
But we have to admit to having an interest in certain Brazilian exports.
And which ones would those be?
Brazil nuts.
As you probably know, we Americans, North Americans, sorry, are growing ever more conscious of our health. Obsessed might not be too strong a word.
We Brazilians are the same. It reflects our general vanity.
Nuts are growing in popularity back home, since they've acquired a reputation as a superfood, containing numerous valuable micronutrients. Brazil nuts are in considerable demand.
And what do you wish of us?
Well, we understand that Manaus is a major transshipment point for Brazil nuts, and it's my understanding that River of Dreams, as an import-export concern, is highly experienced in navigating the sometimes tangled Brazilian export regulations. Now, this is all still somewhat speculative, I have to admit, but my associate and I were hoping to discuss the prospects of going into business with your company.
That sounds fantastic. At the moment, River of Dreams handles no cargoes of Brazil nuts. However, your suggestion certainly has merit. I will certainly have to consult with my superiors before we can possibly discuss details. I hope that's all right with you both.
Of course.
If you have business cards?
Unfortunately, we were both robbed in Belém. Among other things, we lost all our business cards.
Oh, dear, that's terrible. There is so much crime in Brazil these days. It's a wonder anyone comes here.
We did manage to keep our cell phones, at least. Here's my number. Again, my name is Anne Callender.
I'm curious as to how you happened to hear about River of Dreams Trading Company.
Oh, I overheard my father telling some of his cronies about a business associate who'd had dealings with you. A German, a dealer in medical electronics.
Ah, that would be Herr Lindmüller. Reinhard Lindmüller.
I'm terrible with names.
I'm afraid I have bad news regarding Herr Lindmüller. He was killed this spring in a climbing accident in the United States. The irony is, he had a fear of heights. Perhaps he was trying to overcome his fears by confronting them directly. Irony, as I say.
Even though the sun was setting, the temperature hadn't dropped since they'd entered the building. 900 miles up the Amazon basin from the sea, Manaus was even hotter and more humid than Belém. It also struck Anya as a lot harder-edged.
That was a waste of time.
What would you have done? Just asked why a murdered woman in Belém had an invoice from here clutched in her hand?
Well, yeah.
What would you expect them to say? And what would you say if they started asking us how we knew about that? Who would we be placing at the scene of the crime? An actual River of Dreams employee or just ourselves?
Well, you think they'd dare go to the cops?
Why not? First off, we're the ones who fled the scene of an apparent double murder and arson. Remember, the Brazilian authorities like to toss the occasional tourist into one of their prisons just to show everyone who's boss. And in a country with such Byzantine regulations, a company like this one doesn't do business without having some friends in high places.
Okay, you make good points. But what was the point in coming here, then?
This is our only lead. Or at least the only one Publico's seen fit to share with us, after we turned it up ourselves. At least we've done reconnaissance.
And what have we learned?
That if they know anything, they're going to be a tough nut to crack. What do you think?
Well, Mr. Toby seemed pretty smooth. I have to admit he didn't strike me as the type to blurt out deep, dark secrets just because we happened to ask probing questions.
At least we have a pretext for continuing communication with them. Much as I hate to admit I'm stumped, I'm about ready to ask Publico what exactly he has in mind.
We might not have to go so far as that just yet. Even though the building looks pretty glossy from the front, security isn't too tight. I think we might just want to pay them a visit after hours.
You are not talking about breaking in.
Got a better plan?
Dan, Anya, and Sir Ian Moran stood by the rail before the entryway to the Manaus Opera House, facing the high, white-columned entrance with its arched top. Large banners announced an international film festival for the evening. Anya and Dan still wore the clothes they'd worn to the frustrating interview with Toby a couple of hours earlier. She was feeling increasingly dowdy as the night's audience filed into the extravagant, domed Belle Époque Theater. Publico was dressed in immaculate white tie evening dress. His graying blonde hair swept down to his shoulders. The hair, the black tailcoat, and stiff white shirt combined with Publico's own physical presence to produce an almost overwhelming effect.
The notion does have its merits.
We're talking about breaking and entering here.
You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, Anya.
Dan has a pretty rough and ready approach. It's what you might expect from a hardened activist. I do have to point out that the stakes are pretty high in this game, Anya.
You don't have to tell me. People have been killed.
Ah, and isn't that an indication that we're on the right track then? You know, there's even a district of the city named Zumbi dos Palmares.
After the legendary last leader of the Quilombo dos Palmares, I'm guessing. You think that's a clue, Sir Ian?
Why not?
He's a popular historic figure in Brazil. There are places and things named for Almirante Cochrane all over South America, too. That doesn't seem to indicate there's a secret conclave of Napoleonic-era British admirals dwelling away up in the wilds of the Amazon Basin.
A hit. A palpable hit, dear lady. Maybe I feel so strongly about this quest of ours that I tend to see things that aren't there. Still, there's the little fact that my poor friend Reinhard dealt with River of Dreams.
I still don't know why you didn't see fit to share that little nugget of information with us.
I didn't want to prejudice you. I thought it important for you to develop leads on your own.
What are you holding back now so you won't prejudice us?
She has got a point, Sir Ian.
To be sure, believe me, I hold back nothing vital. either to our quest or to your own survival. I will tell you that you're on the right track, and that we need to know what can be learned from River of Dreams.
With all due respect, Sir Ian, that is not an entirely satisfactory answer.
My lovely companions arrive. If you'll forgive me, it would be uncivilized of me to keep these ladies waiting.
Publico left, embraced by two beautiful women, one blonde and Nordic-looking, one exotically African. Their own evening gowns put Anya in mind of the old phrase, a lick and a promise. After all, it was about all they seemed to consist of. She turned a ferocious scowl on Dan. He shrugged, then waggled his eyebrows at her.
Come on. Let's go get something to eat. I'm starving.
As Anya and Dan walked back towards the hotel, she hugged herself as if chilled, despite barely being able to stand the heat. The smell of exhaust, ubiquitous at the center of any modern city, couldn't overpower the omnipresent scent of the rainforest. Stronger here than in Belém. Maybe that was why Manaus felt off somehow to Anya. She had a sense that this was temporary, an aberration. The city and all those within it seemed to exist in a bubble that could simply collapse at any minute.
Look, Anya, I know you're reluctant about breaking into the River of Dreams warehouse. I won't lecture you about bourgeois sensibilities.
Good.
I will point out that Publico has reason to believe these people, the people of this lost city, are hoarding secrets that could ease much misery and suffering on Earth. Secrets that should be shared with all humankind. Secrets that need to be shared with all humankind. Are you with me on this?
I guess so.
Good. We'll make an activist out of you yet.
Maybe.
Dan lifted his arm and crooked it out. Anya stared at it for a moment, refusing to meet what she was sure was his hopeful gaze. Then she wound her arm through his. Wearing a fluffy terry robe and a towel wrapped around her hair, Anya came around the stepped glass brick wall that separated the bathroom from the rest of the room. She picked up her notebook computer from the table by the window and carried it to the bed. She intended to review her email, answer anything that demanded it. Then to relax, she'd browse the newsgroups. Despite enjoying her arm-in-arm walk home with Dan, she had said a firm goodbye once they reached their floor. She was a big girl and could take care of herself. The truth was, she had no clue what had really happened last night in Belém. Neither, she was sure, did Dan. She liked him, even respected him, though she acknowledged he had thorns and hitches in his step. She knew they, like the powerful currents of anger that ran not too far beneath his flip, hip surface, grew out of caring. He cared deeply about the world's poor, about the planet itself. She also knew he had not just seen but experienced horrible things in the Third World. Maybe he was tied to Ogum, and maybe for a good reason. The fairly hideous tropical flower pattern bedspread was turned down. A green foil-wrapped mint waited on the pillow. As she approached the bed, she noticed that the fabric at the foot of it seemed to be moving, ever so slightly. Just as she froze, the motion ceased. She couldn't be sure if she had actually seen what she thought she had. After all, she hadn't exactly been sleeping much of late. Deliberately, Anya stooped and set the computer on the bedside table, then grasped the covers with her hand. Fangs extended like spears as a big black and gray snake struck at her face. By reflex, she turned her body counterclockwise, thrusting out her right hand. She caught the snake about 8 inches behind the head. It thrashed in her hand, trying again to strike at her face. She jerked her head away, then lost her balance. Anya knew if she let go, she would die. She recognized the serpent as an Urutu, a South American pit viper, like a rattlesnake minus the rattles, but certainly not minus the venom. It must have been a good 6 feet in length. Anya felt as if she were trying to hang on to an out-of-control fire hose. Somehow, she kept her grip and managed to get her other hand around the snake's body below her first. It turned and struck for her forearm, striking only air. It could not double back upon its own sinuous body far enough to sink fangs in her flesh.
Okay. Now what do I do with you?
She remembered seeing snake collectors dump their captives in bags. That seemed her best bet. Holding the snake gingerly away from her at the extent of her right arm, she groped behind her for a pillow with her left hand. Grabbing it by the closed end, she shook out the pillow. With the little finger and ring finger of her right hand and her whole left hand, she managed to get the pillowcase open. Anya expected the snake to explode into wild action on finding itself trapped. Instead, it subsided into fat, fleshy coils and, as far as she could tell, went promptly to sleep.
Well, that was anticlimactic.
She held up the improvised bag, reminding herself to stay aware. The animal couldn't bite its way out of the pillowcase, but if it happened to brush against her, it might still manage to sink its fangs in. Anya carried the knotted pillowcase to the bathroom door, then very cautiously hung it over the knob. When she let go, she held herself poised to dive away in case being allowed to hang against the door woke the viper and gave it leverage somehow to strike at her. But the captive did nothing. Anya walked over to the bedside.
Hello, front desk? I have a little problem.
Anya sat in the lobby, replying to the rapidly increasing number of emails landing in her inbox from colleagues back home. She had ducked out of the hotel early for breakfast solo at a nearby cafe, then got back without getting rained on. She had decided that morning to say nothing about the snake incident to either Dan or Sirian. Sharing it could only add complications. She also decided against warning Dan a similar attempt might be made on his life. He had already acted like an old scared alley cat with his head on a swivel whenever he walked out on the street. He struck Anya as being as functionally alert as he could be. Winding him tighter would only feed his paranoia and propensity for anger.
May we join you, Miss Greed?
Anya looked up into the pale amber eyes of Patricinho. At his side, compact and radiantly lovely despite her conservative gray skirt, stood Shia. They both smiled as if Anya were a long-lost cousin.
Sure. Feel free.
Anya felt a certain relief as they seated themselves side by side on the sofa facing her chair across a low coffee table. After the initial shock of the encounter, the chill within her turned quickly into quivery anticipation, like a hunting dog straining at the leash.
What a pleasant surprise to see you both.
Likewise. What brings you to Manaus? And where's your very handsome friend?
To answer the second question first, either still in his room or getting breakfast.
Ah, too bad.
Please, forgive us. We Brazilians are terrible romantics.
I notice you say we.
I am one of the worst.
As for your first question, our research continues here in Manaus.
That's a long way to go afield to look for Quilombos. Am I mistaken, or were they not mainly a coastal phenomenon?
I thought so too, but our employer asked us to look into documents available here at the library and university. We have come across hints there might actually have been Quilombos established even farther upriver after the fall of Palmares. And there is a neighborhood here named for Zumbi of the Palm Nation.
There are lots of neighborhoods named for him, even down in the Pampas, where surely no Quilombos ever were.
Still, how fascinating would it be if there was still something in it all? A lost civilization.
Patricinho likes to let his imagination roam free. Anyway, if his city really has been lost all this time, might that not be strictly accidental? Perhaps the citizens don't want to be found.
What are you doing here?
Anya turned around to see Dan standing tall, frowning. Shia smiled dazzlingly at him.
Conversing with your delightful associate Anya, of course.
Sit down, Dan.
If you mean, what are we doing here in this rather charmless and remote city of Manaus? We simply have business here.
Do you deal with the River of Dreams Trading Company at all?
Sometimes. Our business naturally brings us to Amazon Estate on a regular basis. You know, of course, there are no roads from here to the coast.
I know most of what moves through the interior goes by air. Or by river, obviously, here in the Amazon Basin.
Indeed. Manaus is the natural hub for the deep Amazon trade. Especially since it's the farthest ocean-going ships can travel up the river. That naturally draws us. River of Dreams is what we might term a middle-scale company. So, yes, we deal with them on occasion.
So, what do you make of our Brasilia, Dan?
Mostly, I see oppression and environmental rape. Despite your socialist president, unbridled capitalism is destroying the rainforest for profit. No offense, of course.
Of course not.
You might wish to be cautious assigning blame. Yes, the rainforest is being destroyed to make some people rich, such as the soya growers, who sell their produce to your health-conscious fellow Northern Americans. But were you to look deeply into our politics, you might see that the motive for the destruction is not primarily economic. The government subsidizes it out of a desire to exterminate the Indians by devastating their habitat. It is the great unacknowledged shame of South and Central America, this ongoing genocide against the natives.
Isn't it fashionable for capitalists to blame the government for their crimes these days?
But don't you find that the capitalists who commit the greatest crimes do so with the active cooperation of the government?
I admit I wouldn't mind seeing this whole city plowed under and returned to the rainforest.
And the people of the city? Would not many innocents suffer?
I've been all around the world. I've seen a lot of suffering. I've seen a lot of damage to the planet. And one thing I've learned, there are no innocents.
You don't mean that, Dan.
It may be easier to see such things from your vantage point than mine, my friend. Well, we do not wish to intrude any longer. You have important matters to attend to. For that matter, so do we.
Anya rose politely with Shia and Patricinho, but Dan sat with arms tightly crossed over his chest, glaring at the Brazilian pair as if they were capitalist fat cats with dollar signs all over their suits.
Farewell. Perhaps our paths will cross again.
That would be lovely. Nice going, Karl Marx.
I don't suppose it occurred to you there might be something a little bit suspicious about them turning up right here in Manaus at the same time we're here? Not to mention how they chanced to be passing through our very hotel.
Of course it did. It also occurred to me my best chance of getting anything useful out of them was to play along. Did it ever occur to you to give me credit for having any brains?
Yeah, eventually it'll sink in, I hope. I found that every time I underestimate you, I wind up nursing bruises in places I never knew I could get bruised. So you suspect they know something.
Coincidences just seem to keep piling up, don't they? Wasn't it Sun Tzu who said, "Once is chance, twice is happenstance, three times is enemy action"?
Actually, Anya, it was Goldfinger in the Ian Fleming novel. I love those books.
Isn't that like the ultimate celebration of imperialism, Sir Ian?
You'd be happier if you learned to separate politics from entertainment, Dan, my boy.
Do you?
Well, sometimes I do. That's what I recommend. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Did you spend the night at the hotel?
No. A private residence. Allow an old man his fleeting pleasures, son.
Well, Sir Ian, you might be interested to learn that we just had an interesting encounter.
Anya quickly filled Publico in on the peculiar appearance of Shia and Patricinho, seemingly out of nowhere. She didn't see any need to mention Dan's hostility toward them. The more she thought about it, the more she understood it. If they actually had guilty knowledge of Mafalda's death and the attempts on Dan's and Anya's lives, they were nothing but smiling murderers, or accomplices at the very least. To Anya, it was looking more and more as if Sir Ian was right in his assessment of the Promasons. And if what they suspected was true, they might be a whole culture of narcissistic sociopaths. Publico stood by, nodding and looking thoughtful.
Doesn't it seem to you we might be stirring things up, then? It seems to me that might just indicate we're getting closer to our goal.
One way or another. What now?
There may be documents to be found in the city's libraries that hold clues. If you're lucky, Anya, you might just be finding one that'll let you off of having to do anything you might find distasteful.
Rogue Angel is continued on the next CD.